netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. Well, coming up all next week, we'll have podcasts from the National Association of Broadcasters show in Las Vegas. Should be really, really interesting. But this week, we have one of our sort of interesting topics that we've been following for some time now. It's an interview with the Art Directors Guild President, Tom Walsh. And it was done by Jeff Huser, who joins me now. Jeff, this is something you'd wanted to do for a while, isn't it?
Well, people that have been following the Labor series of podcasts will know that I've talked to the president of the Animation Guild a couple of times now, Steve Hewlett. And I've been trying to get that broadened into other guilds and find out, get more perspective and get more information. I'm trying to get more experts. You know, there's been a lot of momentum lately in this topic with town halls and things like that and a lot of discussions. And I feel like the best thing for me to do with the podcast is to go out and get experts and people who have a position who can speak to some of these issues directly. So I was really excited that Tom agreed to do this.
Yeah, because a lot of the opinions have, centered around the idea of something should be done and someone should do something. But you're absolutely right. It's really interesting to find out what can actually be done and also what the position is of these already quite well-established guilds and unions are. In fact, Art Directors has been going for years now, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Many, many years. And, what I learned from this, and you'll hear in the interview, is these different guilds have very specific defined areas of responsibility and things that they can and can't do. And visual effects may not fall into that, and it may be up to the International Guild, the IATSE, to actually decide what they want to do with visual effects moving forward. He doesn't have any knowledge of that he can speak about, but that seems to be the sense I'm getting, that they have defined responsibilities that they handle, but that moving beyond that is not something they're capable of or interested in doing. It does cover a lot of things that we deal with in visual effects.
Well, it's no secret that I'm not an American. So let me ask you this. How relevant is this discussion, do you think, to people outside the US? Because many of the issues that have reared their head in what have been fairly much Hollywood-centric discussions are also being faced by our sort of colleagues around the world, be them in Mumbai, Canada, London, or Sydney.
Well, and I keep trying in all these conversations to drag it back to a global perspective. And when I hear people use phrases like keep the business here, it kind of makes me recoil a little bit because I just think that there is a global industry and it's a global problem. And the thing with the guilds that is a little bit worrisome is that there is no way for a guild to be, even though they use the word international in their name, there is no international in the guilds. But the problems, I feel, are so much the same. We hear the stories of artists worldwide going through the same problems, dealing with crazy schedules, dealing with, uncompensated work, insane expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually on the local board of the Visual Effects Society in Australia, and the Visual Effects Society, as you have identified in your earlier podcast, literally cannot get involved in a kind of labor organized capacity. It's just completely outside the mandate of the society. And yet, the Visual Effects Society is relatively international. I guess it's a problem not only of whether or not you can form internationally, but there must be a certain amount of concern here locally that if you were to galvanize together into an organized union in, for example, America, this would drive work to those other markets.
I think that falls in the misunderstanding category. I really do think it's a perception problem. The unions, the guilds, the way I understand it, and the way you'll hear Tom talk about it, really are there to establish minimums and to represent the workers in terms of working conditions and working practices and suggestions for that and getting the studios to sign on to those practices. I think that I don't think that's a fair... I know it's a fair worry. I know that that's what people are concerned about, but I think you'll hear Tom talks about that pretty specifically in the podcast. But, I just see, when you look at the camera, when you look at the cinematographers, they've got the ASC and they've got the Local 600. The art directors, they mentioned the fact that they, as a guild, kind of form a dual purpose. They are trying to represent the artists as a labor union, but also as a society, much like the Visual Effects Society does. When you look at visual effects, we don't have the second arm of that. We only have the Visual Effects Society, which, like you point out, is very limited into what it can do in terms of helping the artist beyond a certain point.
Yeah, look, it is a very complicated issue, and it's not a simple one. I guess I'm a huge advocate of, or I have voiced before my concern that for an industry as significant to the bottom line as the effects industry is to the film industry in particular, and I'm not just picking on the film industry because this obviously happens in commercials and other areas, but for something that's this guaranteed almost to contribute to box office opening weekend, to have this little power in terms of looking after its quote stars and just, you know, those stars being facilities, that it seems, because, you know, we have had, I don't know how many stories this year of facilities closing, and
right,
and yet there is absolutely no way that that is indicative of there being less visual effects work.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. And my main goal in this is in terms of the guild, is when I look at the Journey to the Center of the Earth artists, for example, the fact that there's not a guild there means that the artists are left on their own. So they stop getting paid, and they talk amongst themselves, and nobody takes a unified stand as to what the process should be. If that was a guild situation, they would go to a guild representative, and the guild representative would go to management and say, we as artists cannot accept this not getting paid. We need a check by X date, or we stop work. And that's the only power the artists have, is in that unified form. Those kind of situations, and I'm also concerned for the youth. We have it's a very young industry. We tend to constantly bring in newer and younger people. And in a younger age, and people in their 20s, for example, coming into the industry aren't thinking about retirement plans, aren't thinking about benefits per se, you know, at that moment. That's not high on your priority list. And I think that I've got a couple other podcasts planned to talk about those things specifically, personal stories from people within guilds about how being a member of the guild accidentally along the way in their careers kind of helped them in the future. So these are kind of the issues. This is why I keep coming back to this topic. But I do think it needs to be, you know, shared globally. The information needs to be shared globally, and people need to talk about these issues globally because it is a global problem. It's not just a Los Angeles problem, even though sometimes the context seems to be focused that way.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to give up a family life to have a successful career, and you shouldn't have to work in a position whereby, you know, somebody makes vast amounts of money off you and you're in absolutely no position to reap any benefits from that. I'm not saying that anyone working in the visual effects industry is, you know, hard done by compared to somebody working in a third world sweatshop or anything like that. But, you know, fair's fair in an industry that is highly professional, highly skilled, and has huge revenues. It's only fair that artists should be looked after and treated accordingly. Well, let's cross now to your interview recorded earlier with Tom Walsh.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tom.
My pleasure.
So let's start off with a little bit of your background.
I'm a practicing production designer and art director. I'm a native of California, which is a rare thing. My father was a contract actor at MGM in the 40s, and then a traveling comedian in the lounge circuit of Vegas and Tahoe and Honolulu. So I grew up kind of out of the trunk and traveling the road with him. A graduate of Hollywood High School, so I've been essentially working as a narrative artist all of my life. Out of high school, I went into the trades. I was accepted in the early program at CalArts, and they had lots of problems, as anybody who knows the history of CalArts. And so they canceled the program. So I instead started working in the trades, first as a union carpenter at a Local 33, working at then what NBC was a very robust, exciting place to work over there in Burbank, and then the Music Center. My bent at that time was mostly theater, because growing up here, the unions were very, I know this is a surprise to you, the unions were very hard to get into. It was just like, it was the catch-22. How do I get in? Well, you have a relative, or somehow, you know, the gods take, you know, kindness upon you. So, and it was much easier to work in the theater, though the theater was a very unnatural thing to be doing in L.A., because it's always been an industry town, and, you know, you could never get a job based on a theater portfolio. You would show it somewhere, and they said, yeah, but can you do film? It's all narrative design at the end, but there's always been a partitioning of the work here worse than any place else. So after a while, I got my card as a scenic artist, actually. I migrated over and painted as a scenic artist, then 816. And then CalArts reinstated the program, went back for a couple of years and got my degree, came back out, was the resident assistant designer at the Mark Taper Forum for 3.5, 4 years. And then my wife and I moved back to New York because most of our work was still in the theater and opera, and there was still no real avenues to get in. It was right just before the explosion of independent work in film and television here. So, and the wonderful thing about New York at that time, and it still is it's a place where there are no partitions in terms of the work. It gets a small marketplace, so you're equally respected whether you're doing commercials, television, theater, film. And the crossover of work disciplines was fully expected and respected. So, and that has still not changed out here. You come out here and you are pigeonholed. You are a feature person, or you're a television person, or you are you do commercials. It's really insane. So anyway, after 13 years in New York, I found myself doing finally more film and television because the New York Union represented designers working in television and film. And I came back here and continued to pursue working independent. By that time, the IA would become very aggressive in terms of organizing independent production across the country. And so they were bringing in practitioners from with very mixed sort of backgrounds in, because they realized the only way you can maintain dominance over an area is to include the practitioners. And so everyone essentially who was non-union became union over a period of 6 or 8 years. In fact, I was doing Flipper for Universal, and we were shooting it in the Bahamas at the time the IA was holding their national convention in Miami. So they sent a contingent over the Bahamas and organized the show. And so that's how I actually became a member of what was in 876, the Art Directors Union, was through that organizing effort on the part of the IA. And I've been a member for a dozen or more years. I've lost track. And I've been president of the union. I've just been elected for my third term, so I'm going into my sort of my eighth year of representation of the guild. I've never been sort of the militant union kind of member organizer, but I've always been a strong believer in right and wrong and trying to protect members' interests. So that's kind of what brings me here to today, is kind of representing interests of and knowing how international, global, diversified our industry is coming, and the fact that if we don't communicate better on all levels, we're going to just sort of sink into the mire.
Right. Can you tell me about the Art Directors Guild? What job classifications, what parts of the industry does the Art Directors Guild represent?
The Art Directors Guild was originally founded in the early 20s, and it's became a formal member of the IA in the early 60s. And I keep half-jokingly say that we're schizophrenic, because we have kind of two sides. One side of the brain is a labor organization, which deals with health, welfare, and contract issues, and workplace conditions. And hopefully standards and practices, and that's one of our things, is to raise the level of our standards and practices in terms of through education of our members. The other side is more a professional society side, like the ASC or VES or any of those organizations that's concerned about more communicating the craft and raising the appreciation and respect for the craft. Because of labor, the amount of energy it takes and resources it takes to maintain a labor operation, that kind of always gets the dominant amount of the pie that we have to spend, because our money comes from members' dues dollars. So we have to be, obviously we are transparent in terms of the manager of that, but we also have a responsibility first and foremost to deal with the issues that affect them in terms of their working conditions. So that's kind of what, and in terms of our membership, we have almost 2,000 members representing art director, production designers. If you want to go through the food chain, I mean, our craft is essentially art direction. That's what we do. We're in the practice of art direction. The different practitioners within that craft are production designers, who are essentially the head of the food chain, the head of the department, art directors, who are now associates to the production designers in terms of the execution of the tasks and managing of the team process. And then you have illustrators, concept artists, mat artists, set designers, model makers. And that represents three of our branches. Our fourth branch is the scenic artist branch, which also represents courtroom illustrators. Within the illustrator branch, we also have storyboard artists. For the longest time, since the early 50s, the art department actually became partitioned through IA organizing. The art directors seemed to be the longest to hold out, because they didn't come into the IA until the early 60s. The set designers and model makers and the illustrators, mad artists, seemed to be the first to join the IA. And there you saw the first partitioning of the art department in Los Angeles, where no longer group with like-minded interests were represented by one IA local, but by, in essence, three different locals. And so it was a long time coming. We just finished, over the last year and a half, a reorganization and the merging of those three locals into one. So now the Art Directors Guild represents, in essence, the total spectrum of the art department practitioners, as are required in the making of a feature movie or television event today.
So when you mention all those job titles, there's a lot of those that I have to imagine get more complicated as we move into a very digital age, where sets are routinely extended, completely synthetic, things like that. How does that affect the guild? Obviously, we're looking and discussing this from a visual effects standpoint.
Right.
At some point, it seems that a lot of things that are being done in visual effects companies would fall under your jurisdiction.
Yeah, and historically, visual effects came out of the art department. I mean, the earliest sort of managers and practitioners of it were all art directors or assistant art directors who really liked working tactile with special effects. So in all the studios, you look at the early roles, and it was a mix of camera department, editorial, and the art direction. But much of the management and the creative supervision came out of the art department because it was a natural fundamental thing. And the interchange was complete. A matte painting, forget whether it's done with a mouse or a brush, was always the extension of something that was created in the art department. So that dialogue and supervision always had to be maintained throughout. And when it was a factory system, obviously the roles were very clear and the exchange was very clear. And the mutual respect and learning was hugely clear. Obviously, in the 60s and by the 70s, when we saw all but the dissolving of the studio infrastructure as we know it in terms of the departments interworking with one another, everything became outsourced. And, like with Star Wars, is when it was essentially reinvented, the whole visual effects process. And it was reinvented outside of the structure of a studio. So I think that set the sort of the new model for independent shops providing these services that the studios, as we know, don't want to have infrastructure, don't want to, they're not interested in R&D. I mean, Avatar is $400 million because there was no studio investment in R&D other than through Cameron. But if it was really, they leave it now to the practitioners to move the bar, and which is very sad, but that's kind of the way it is. So we, today, digital tools are really, our membership for the longest time were analog based. And it wasn't until obviously digital tools became fundamentally affordable and accessible, the software and such, to individual practitioners as opposed to these companies that had proprietary softwares and machinery, that our members started to realize, become empowered. As is a lot of visual effects practitioners who've set up their mom-and-pop shops, because they become empowered. They no longer need the big R&D of the big company to provide a service that they become knowledgeable in. So it kind of has created both a confusion and a need for a sort of a recalibrating of where we are together. I mean, the truth is, anything that involves the preconception of a film, anything pre, and post as well, because it should ultimately come from the initial, unless you want to reinvent the wheel at all those costs, it should still come from the initial conception, which comes through pre-production into production, because it's all those assets now we're realizing and trying to become smart about file sharing and migration of files. All of those assets that happen in pre and production move on to post or inherited by post for the final realization. And with the visual tools now, the digital tools now, we're no longer a linear workflow, as we know. Things are happening non-linear, and that exchange of information, things are being finished earlier on because, as we know, there's this contraction to the post-production process, which is almost becoming not a post-production process. And the post-production is happening during the filming of now, because the release dates are becoming so constricted.
Well, and that kind of brings us to previs. I know that there's a lot of directors and films where previs is very important to them. And in fact, you've seen split-screen demos of the previs with the final film, and even animation characteristics have been carried through all the way through to the finished film from previs, and really, really, faithful to the previs. So previs obviously would seem like it would fall into this. I understand you guys have recently started to go into organizing previs.
Well, it's not, we're, I wouldn't say that we're organizing, because what we're doing is reaffirming our contracted jurisdictions within the IA contracts. Now, you can go offshore and do anything you want, as we know. Or you can do a completely non-union movie and do anything you want. But if you're doing a film that is based on the standing working agreements, then the rules are very clear. So if anything, we are reaffirming to those members. Because, I mean, the studios, let's face it, I mean, not the studios, the unions have done a very bad job at trying to ever encourage new membership. I mean, it is a balkanized kind of mentality. We're here to protect our own, which is the wrong thing. I mean, unless you represent the workforce, you have no control over the workplace. It's that simple. And
well, it's funny, when I've talked to people about this, that I was coming to talk to you, and in following up in some of the previous interviews with like Steve Hewlett at the mm-hmm. Animation Guild, the two things I hear all the time are, it's very hard to get into the unions, to become a member of the guild, and it's a lot of people have a real negative reaction to the whole concept of a union. And I mean, my history goes back to the old television station right. days when engineers were in the union and very strong, and there was a general perception, I think there's still a general perception by a lot of people, that you know, it's protecting the workers who really just can't, you know, shouldn't be protected, you know, that right. maybe the weaker right. that shouldn't be able to stand on their own, and they're kind of protected. And I don't know if things have evolved from that, if that's a bad perception.
Well, it's not an unrealistic perception. The truth is, the unions have some huge responsibilities that they have to step up to. And I'm not speaking for the IA. This is my perception, and I could be voted out at some point, and everyone wants to go back to whatever they want to do. But the truth is, as we know, the studios don't care about education. Hopefully, they'll continue to give us money to encourage education, but it's not their mandate. They're in business to produce a product, and they want to use knowledgeable, experienced practitioners to produce that product. They're not interested in training them, unlike in the studios past, because in the studios in the old days almost functioned as advanced graduate schools for these architects and these designers that came in. They really learned from one another, and there was sort of a joy and pride of their industry that the studios represented, which kind of we've lost. It's really individual practitioners providing a service now. So with that in mind, all of this, the guilds, not just the art directors, have to be more proactive in training their members, especially as we know technology changes so fast. And anyone who thinks they're ahead of their game, at the head of their game, they're that way for about 45 minutes. And then they fall back in line as somebody knows the next widget a little bit better, and you learn from each other. So we have a huge responsibility, speaking for the guild, to upgrade our members and raise the level of standards and practices. Because during that period, as I mentioned, when the IA was doing mass organizing, there was no emphasis on past experience or your abilities. It was like, you're doing it, you're a member of us now. So it kind of diluted the level of competence within and knowledge base within the workforce. And we have to make up for that. We have to try and raise all boats together the best we can. Now, we can't make members who are members learn things that they don't want to learn them. We can do kind of certifications that say these members have learned certain things, so as you hire, you know you're getting the best practitioner. But we're not there to beat up on our members and say, you got to take these classes, because we can't do that. But at the same time, the unions also have a responsibility to acknowledge, especially with new technologies, that sometimes your enlightenment and your advancement comes from outside as well as inside. So, for example, people who have grown up with the new tools and are working and being hired providing those new tools, that those new tools are still doing what the old tools always did, we have to welcome them. We have to say, if you can demonstrate that you've been produced and you're providing a service that the marketplace desires or needs or requires, especially in, say, the specialty previous tools, then, you know, two things. One, that is our covered work. And B, there's no reason why you can't be a member. And understand that if you've been doing matte painting for the last 10 or 15 years for an independent company, then you are doing our work. We have always been representing matte painters.
So explain to me how that works. Let's say there is a matte painter out there who has been doing this for years, mm-hmm. and they're working at a company, and they're called a matte painter, and they mm-hmm. do matte paintings every day, but the company's not a signatory to any kind of guild or anything. So right. How does that work?
Well, the individual should still come to the guild and say, I would like to become a member. And the guild, in turn, will say, welcome aboard, sailor. And
but at that point, what do they accomplish with that? I mean, they'd be paying dues, obviously, and becoming a member of the guild.
Yeah, and it's not to say that the company they're working for is going to become a signatory. We would certainly approach the company and say, you know, especially if, you know, you have more than one member. If they come as a group, if they want to be organized, then that is certainly an opportunity for the IA to try and bring the company on board. Irrespective of that, it opens up other opportunities. As we know, we're such a freelance market that on their next hire, they say, I'm a member of A29, this is our contract. It always has been. And the truth is, especially with matte painters in particular, we've always had that covered work. So if those people are working, providing a service to any union signatory film, they're not getting the benefits they should be getting. You know, it's just, and a part of it is because we're not talking about it, and there's the mystique about, well, I'll never get in the union. How do I get in the union? Nobody understands all of that. And the union kind of revel, the unions, plural, kind of revel in the ambiguity of that, because again, it's a reluctant moving forward. It's not like they're aggressively walking in lockstep to bring all these new people in, because there are the people that are on the inside that are also definitely concerned about the diluting of their work opportunities. I think we all know, especially in the digital age and the age of the freelancer, which we all are, we're freelancers ultimately, is you get your work by your own abilities, by your own capabilities, by your own networking. We're not the art directors in particular is not a hiring hall. We don't, you know, we represent a credible workforce, but it's up to the individual to find, nurture, and extend their own workplace opportunities.
Could an artist find themselves in a situation though where they were to be approached for a job, mm-hmm. and they say, well, I'm in the guild, mm-hmm. and this company kind of would not be interested in that because it would put them in a more financial responsibility situation?
When you actually look at the costs, especially with health and welfare and stuff, we're not really talking about money. We're talking about the perception that, you know, we're giving something to the unions that they haven't gotten at the bargaining table, in essence. And the truth is, we do. I mean, if you're working in the pre-visualization of a movie, you're working in what is already our covered territory. So, you know, if anything, you're gaining by being guaranteed that as a freelancer, wherever you go, you will be guaranteed the same rights and privileges that you would, unlike if you were working for an individual company where you're only working under their terms and those terms are not transferable to any place else you might work. And if anyone thinks they're going to be working for any one company for more than a year or two at a time, you're crazy. I mean, it's a global industry. It's going everywhere. So it's our mandate is to make the freelancers' work box of protections as universal as it can be.
Well, let's talk about that. The globalization question, I mean, that's one of the first things people bring up when we start talking about this as well. You know, if everybody goes and forms a visual effects guild, or, you know, everybody gets pulled into one of the existing guilds, they'll just take the work offshore. And my thing with that is always thinking that, you know, the problems don't go away. You know, the problems just move to a different place. Mm-hmm. And at some point, those workers are going to get tired of, you know, abuses
right.
that fall them, and maybe even worse. And I always say, you know, that if you look at a factory strike, right. you know, when the workers break into the warehouse and burn down the warehouse over a labor condition, the product name is what comes out first.
Yeah.
You know, so a movie is going to get tarnished at some point
yeah.
by, I mean, I would say Journey to the Center of the Earth with the workers that got mm-hmm. Hurt up in Canada. I would say that Journey to the Center of the Earth has this kind of black mark against it, for example.
Right.
So I would think that it's in everybody's interest to kind of think about these things on a global level, the studios as well as the artists. But, you know, jurisdiction and things. I mean, is there a way for the guilds to expand themselves to a more global...
I don't know that they can. You know, we're not, you know, the guilds, it's not in their interest to become a global power. I mean, it's not about power. It's about representing the workforce and getting fair working conditions. Beyond that, all we can do is set minimums anyway and working standards. After that, it's up to the individuals to protect their own best interests still. I mean, we're there to support them, but ultimately, if you want, the only thing they can't do is work in substandard conditions to what the contracts have, you know, struggled to protect them for. You know, so if they're going to work independent, well, that's going to be their choice. But they can't then come to the union and say, I'm not getting the same privileges and benefits that I would be if I was working under a union contract. Once you go on to the union contract, you still have the choice to go independent. You shouldn't, because it undermines the whole process and effort and what it all represents. But that's your individual call. You know, we are a global industry, and there's no getting around it. And we'll see, especially visual effects, China and India, New Zealand. I mean, why was half of Avatar done down in New Zealand? It was cheaper, you know, and they had a talented work pool there that could do the work. The truth is still all of this global industry of ours is still managed by essentially power brokers and financial interests that are based in Southern California. And as much as they can do teleconferencing and try and keep their finger in the pie, they want to bring things still under their control at some point in the process. And the times that they really control the process the most is in pre-production, when the big decisions are being made and the project is being greenlit and the costs and the money is being allocated, and in post-production, when they want to, again, be in very tight control. And most of our practitioners are most heavily involved in pre-production and post-production. So, I mean, ultimately, there's a reason to be somewhat optimistic that not all the work for everything will go offshore. It's always going to get parceled out, because that's just the way this industry works now, and technology and communication and software permits that. We can't bring that back. Those cows are way out in the pasture. What we can do is compete. And we compete by having the most experienced and professional workforce that can provide the service with the least amount of reinvention, because the first time or second time or third time is done badly and has to be redone. I mean, they're always going to, the producers will always delude themselves that there's a cheaper, faster, lower rent way to do it. But ultimately, when you're especially dealing with these really high-end expensive products, they're going to want to do them in the most professional way they can, as they're to indemnify themselves against, you know, catastrophic failure at somewhere down the workflow. So, I mean, I say I'm not delusional that, you know, we can manage, or I or the guild, we can manage or control this sort of multicultural, international workplace. But what we can do is work hard to bring those that are most employable. I'm not talking about people who are marginal or just getting in. Anyone who can get hired and get a track record of performance capability has, you know, they've got a future for themselves.
One of the things that's come up in some of these town halls that have popped up lately, there was a discussion about if there was a way. I mean, if the first thing to be outsourced is going to be commoditization things, roto, mm-hmm. cleanup,
sure.
You know, those kind of things. That's happening pretty aggressively
now.
Labor-intensive
and the mundane.
Right. Stuff that doesn't need as much creative control, right, as long as the quality is acceptable. Is there a way, because the fear then becomes, okay, well, if all the entry-level jobs leave the United States or leave an area, mm-hmm. then where's the entry-level, where's the business in 5 years?
Right.
So somebody asked in one of these forums, is there a way that a guild would, like, approach when they're doing the contract with a company, would say, you know, can we set aside 10% of this work to be kept here to keep that entry-level pool going?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that would ever be done is that something that could be done?
Well, it depends. If and when a formalization of visual effects within the industry is organized. And that's not for us to do, because we can't do universal organizing. We can only actually work in the areas that the IA permits us and to work and cover. Our covered work represents anything to do with live action. It doesn't have, so that's sort of the clear definition between us and animation, though. I think it's like Polar Express and such really blurs the lines.
Yeah.
You're scratching the head. Well, whose is what now? Ultimately, if it involves essentially performance capture and live action, quote unquote, that's our area. You know, anything to do that's pure animation, pure conceived or contrived and conceived performance through characters, not through live actors, but through characters that are captured through artists working in more or less traditional manners, even though they have new tools to do it. That's the animated world, and, you know, we try to respect each other's jurisdictions there, because we don't want any turf wars.
Well, were you involved with Image Movers Digital then? Was the Directors Guild involved there? Because I know Animation Guild was, and I would think that's one of those classic blur the line.
We had some members who were in the art department who were managing it. As I say, sort of on the managerial side, yes, we had members there. But in terms of the out you know, God bless Zemeckis. They keep sort of blurring, raising the bar and blurring the line on everyone. And at some point, it is all going to be just narrative art. And maybe sometime down the road, it'll kind of reinvent itself. It's very hard to unwrite contracts. And so, and those contracts have very clear jurisdictions. So unless the industry was actually going to be enlightened and try and reinvent the paradigm, which you try and get all those companies together with all of their lawyers to come to a consensus on anything, you know, it'll be the new ice age before you see any of that. So you have to kind of work with the legal tools that you have at your disposal already. So those legal tools say that animators do animation and art directors do art direction for live action. And that kind of is, those are the rules that we have to play under currently because we can't reinvent them.
But let's talk about visual effects specifically. Yeah. Because it seems like you guys skirt a lot of areas. The Animation Guild skirts a lot of areas. It seems like numbers-wise, if I think that you have a couple thousand members, they have a couple thousand members, it would seem that just adding up in my head the companies around Los Angeles that do this and San Francisco that do this kind of work, there's clearly a lot more than that, than that number working actively in visual effects. Does it, I guess what I'm trying to say is, does, if all those workers suddenly became interested in organizing,
right,
does it become something the IA does as a theoretically as a separate thing, a visual effects, or does it kind of parse into these different areas? Or, and I mean, and for example, let's say you guys all of a sudden got 3,000 visual effects artists dumped in your lap.
Right.
Suddenly, you know, the balance of power gets thrown off inside your organization.
Yeah. That would have to come from Olympus and the gods. That's not something that we have the ability to influence or to encourage. As I say, we really have to work with our contracts, which they are, which is puts us more in a creative managerial side. I mean, the work that we do for pre-production and production is very clear, and it's very well delineated in our agreements. The idea of creating a new paradigm where you take visual effects workers and all their different components and apply them to either art direction, the art directing, or to the visual, the animation, is kind of creating a new hybrid of saying we all do the same things now, and we all share the same tools, so we should all be part of the same group. That would, as I said, that require creating all sorts of new contracts that don't exist and new understandings moving forward that would be very hard to get to in a short term. I think the most important thing is to recognize that there are these workers out there that have historically been non-represented and need to get past their fear of representation, that the union is some sort of outdated dinosaur thing that kind of represents past things. And also their anger, some of them carry seated anger of always being excluded. And they have to work through all that. You know, it's no longer about it being excluded. It's about being demonstrated that you have the tool sets that are viable and moving forward. And then defining which area you most properly belong to within the current existing structures of representation and jurisdiction recognition. Beyond that, I do know that the IA will is taking the issues that are at hand very seriously, and hopefully they'll surprise us all with a plan. But I can't speak to the person who's doing the in-between work right now. I can speak to anyone who's doing the creative conceptual work leading up to the in-between work. It is our hope that we will be able to institute, and I think other guilds need to do this as well, institute intern programs so that we can bring those that are creatively interested and motivated, give them real-time experience training so that they'll have a straight, no more the ambiguous catch-22, how do I get in? Well, that's another 30-minute conversation into itself. But we'll have the skill sets and we'll have the training experiences to make direct applications, so no longer do they have to be lucky and get in, but actually we will have a way of, a feeder way of bringing people into our guild moving forward.
It seems to me like the momentum is there right now, that if that people are kind of looking for somebody to say, over here, we're the people you need to talk to, we want to help you do this, first of all. So if the IA is thinking about that, I hope that they would take that to heart, because I really do think that the momentum is there. Right. And I do think, like you say, there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of people with fears and and old understandings of how this could work or would work or might cause problems. And a lot of people are saying there's likely to be, you know, the SAG and AFTRA sync up contract is coming up, what, in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are saying if we're not in the visual effects industry synced up and ready to go before that date, mm-hmm. nobody's going to, if that doesn't go well, mm-hmm. and we end up with another strike on our hands, mm-hmm. there's no way the visual effects would be able to later, after an event like that, you'd be delaying everything years down the road. So it's almost like if there was an opportunity to do this, that seems like the target.
Right.
Is that a fair...
I don't know, because again, we're all trying to read the minds of others that work at a higher level than us in terms of organizing and hopefully the constructive relationship. Because you don't want to have a animosity between labor and producers. I mean, we have more in common than not. What we do want to do is always strive to maintain a fair professional recognition of the values that our practitioners provide, the services we provide to that industry, and we need fair, you know, compensation and recognition for those efforts. One thing we all have in common is we want to keep the work here. I wish I could say that for the producers, because they're looking for the lowest, you know, cost at this point. As you see this insanity that we're going through in the live action side of incentive and rebate chasing. I'm not sure how that affects the visual effects industry in terms of them going offshore as well.
Huge.
But, you know, and it's insanity. All these studios have set up offices that are dedicated just to chase the incentive.
Yep.
And at some point you say, all right, you're now in Detroit, but you don't have the credible workforce. You don't have the infrastructure to support it. But in your mind, you believe you're saving, you know, 30%, 40% off of your investment costs. But no one ever does the exit math, or at least publicizes the exit math in terms of how much more it costs them to produce that product.
Right.
Ultimately, I believe it's usually a wash. They believe it up front because they want to believe that when they're greenlighting the projects.
Well, I've been doing a lot of research on this incentives thing because it has just gotten out of hand. And, you know, I've read that, I know Australia recently was asked to double their incentives because they were losing work to places that were doing 40%, and they were, I think, at 15. And they said no. And Massachusetts, I guess the governor there is really aggressively chasing stopping the incentives, because what they've discovered is that they're not creating industry.
Right.
They're bringing in workers to do short-term work, mm-hmm. who then disperse.
They're setting up brothels.
Yeah. That is a great way to put it. Now, Vancouver seems to be doing it a little bit more successfully.
Well, they've got a history of doing it, though. I mean, that's always been, you know, Canada, their incentive programs have always been our biggest competition in terms of keeping work here. Because we don't provide incentives except on individual basis. I mean, New Mexico has been very successful with it, but as you're pointing out, all these incentive programs are at the depend on the kindness of the legislatures.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Would you want to set? I mean, I know I wouldn't want to go set up a company somewhere that's at the whim of a politician changing their mind.
And we know that happens on an annual basis. So it is a dangerous way. That's why they've set up these offices, so they can keep moving the ball to other places. As they lose one, they'll go, oh, we'll go here. Well, it has nothing to do with our movie. It doesn't matter. You know, we got creative people. They'll figure out how to, you know, make the desert in a snowy condition. You know, it is insane. It is what our times are. And again, the only thing we can do to counter it is to communicate with each other. And I would say tighten the interdependence of the practitioners, because ultimately you need the practitioners to make your movie wherever you're going to make it. Mm-hmm. At the very least, the highest end. And those practitioners, it is a trickle down. They can't do it by themselves. I mean, we're in an industry where you can't do anything by yourself anymore. There's no mm-hmm. one man banding anything. You do need a creative coalition of collaborators to do what we do. And so the more that we integrate our interactions with each other and communicate about what's happening where and how with whom, the better chance we have to have a predominant influence on the work moving forward.
Right. Well, then this is the thing I keep saying too. Unlike past labor efforts in history,
right,
the tool that we have available to us now that I think changes the balance of things is the internet.
Absolutely.
You have high-tech workers globally working on these projects,
yeah,
who are going, you know, when they're packing a bag to go to work on Monday knowing they're not coming home till Friday, mm-hmm. you know, and then they start hearing us through the internet talking about these same issues, right. or not maybe that's an extreme, but you know what I mean? We have this new tool, and I think that even if guilds can't cross international borders per se, the issues are the same for all the workers. I mean, yeah. it's and I do think that if as long as we all talk more about these issues and bring stuff to light and really try to help each other on a global basis, mm-hmm. you know, it's not an us against them. I mean, you know,
and it shouldn't be, because no one benefits from that. You know, what we don't want is wars with one another, because there's more to be gained by all by essentially just being honest and fair and having the dialogue. I mean, you mentioned the, you know, art departments more and more are becoming global in terms of our practitioners. I find more and more that, you know, though they may not want to hire all the people I'd like to bring to a distant place, I can still interact with many of them through, you know, the web.
Sure.
And get the same amount of work done, and the producers saving by not having all those housing and travel and everywhere. It just requires a new way of structuring the art department. But it also still ensures that those people can still be hired as members wherever they are. And the producer wins because he doesn't have to hire, you know, place everybody there, but they're still getting the quality of service. But again, that person who may not be working with me in Detroit or wherever, who's working out of their home in Albuquerque or in Los mm-hmm. Angeles, they should still be members of an organization that'll protect their interests, so that they're getting the same being treated financially the same way that anybody else in the project is being treated. Otherwise, it becomes that sort of back room. Well, we got these guys in the back room who are cheaper, and you can use them as long as you keep them, you know, cheaper.
Yeah.
It's cheaper by saving the producer money in a smart way of saying, all right, you don't have to house them, you don't have to feed them, but they're going to give you the same level of professional service, and it's not ultimately going to cost you any more.
Well, if you have an artist, let's say an art director, who's maybe on a film for 18 months, right. and they're over in Australia, let's just say, they're still covered by the same contracts, they're still paid the same way, their benefits are still the same, right. I'm assuming, even though they're mobile.
Right. No, that's true. It's transferable. It goes, once you're a member and you're working under the contract, and if that shows the signatory of the contract, you get those benefits wherever you are.
Now, what if you're not? What if, let's say you're working in features and, you know, features get slow and you get swooped into commercials and you're mm-hmm. in some small shop working mm-hmm. there, but you're still a member of the guild, mm-hmm. but they're not a signatory. How mm-hmm. does that work? I mean, do you then lose benefits, or is there a threshold you have to hit?
The problem with that, when the companies aren't signatory, they're not allowed, as the way the plans are currently structured, to pay into the plan to the benefit of that individual member. So that becomes, you know, maybe in time that as the union and the producers and the plan become more sort of wishing too much to encourage them to become flexible, but maybe new instruments can be fine. So those individuals, those freelancers, can keep their days. But in the short term, no. If you're working for a non-signatory, you're just going to be getting what you're getting.
Right. I mean, it does seem like something that needs to be looked at, because I can easily see a situation where someone's working on features, for example, migrates over to a smaller company. Or moves into commercials, for example, and finds that they really like the people there, the right. team there, and want to stay there. And now all of a sudden they can't, the whole portable benefits thing that we all right. crave
right.
Suddenly become not portable anymore.
Well, the only sort of protection as a short term is, and a lot of us face this, especially with, you know, the last, both the strikes that we went through, the writer's strike and the de facto actor's strike, a lot of our members were forced out of their... out of the plan in terms of not having sufficient hours to maintain it. And then you have to fall into the stopgap things like COBRA, where it at least allows you to pay into the plan at a slightly higher rate, but you're maintaining your safety net until such time as you go back to a signatory job where they will pay back into the plan on your behalf. So there's a way, once you're in the system, there's a way to kind of bridge it. And again, now that healthcare has passed, God knows how this is going to, this whole issue of insurance paradigm is going to reinvent itself over time. But the bottom line is, you know, one should not be fearful of being a member of a union and then not getting those benefits in every job. One should always try to maintain signatory work. That's kind of your obligation. That being said, it's better to be a member and have the choice of not working as a member if circumstances of life require you to do that, than to not be a member and never have the advantage to any of those benefits that you can accrue over time. You know, it's like you can have nothing and then have a little of something, or you have advantage to everything and then choose as life requires you to choose as you move through it. But at least you're still accruing something if you're a member of the larger organization. If that makes sense. I mean, again, I'm just trying to say that there's nothing to be fearful about being a member and maybe not always working for a company that's going to give you that work. You know, if anything, once everyone's a member, then the companies have less choice but to become signatories because, you know, they don't want to retrain the world every time they're going to do a job. They're always going to go to those leading practitioners that they value, that they know they can maintain their profit margin on because they'll do the job right the first time in, you know, the dedicated amount of time that they budget for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's far easier for the guilds to organize these independent shops if the majority of the practitioners they depend on say, you know, we want to be part of the union. We respect everything you're doing for us, and this is not to dismiss you in any way, but we're looking at long-term. And the long-term says we have more to gain by being part of a larger organization that than you will participate in as well. I mean, it can be a win-win. The companies are fearful of it because I think of the historic things about unions that scare them, whatever those are, you know, but they would have to actually identify them and articulate them. And then we would have actually a platform in which to have an honest dialogue. All right, you're afraid of this or that. Let's talk about that. But they tend to kind of listen to us and then go off and not share that the information with the workforce because they don't, you know, again, an informed workforce is a dangerous thing for a company that's trying to maintain one view of the world.
And so that, and I, you know, I got into this when I was talking with Steve Hewlett again, you know, the question of how do, and you mentioned looking at redefining your roles in the world of getting information out to people. It sounds like the artists need more information,
yes,
on every level, and the companies need a lot. I mean, a lot of, let's face it, in our business, a lot of the companies are formed by artists who aren't necessarily business people who have migrated in through the passion and through the food chain and formed companies. So, you know, there's, you know, a lot of the historical prejudices against a guild might be just that.
Yeah.
So it seems like education on a lot of levels through the internet, through whatever resources possible, would be really helpful.
Education and communication, I think, are the key tools.
And doing things like this. And I really do appreciate you doing this. This is exactly the kind of thing that, you know, I mean, I think we'll have a lot of people listening to this, and I think you've answered a lot of questions. Anything else you wanted to bring up?
No, I mean, again, I would just say that if you are a practitioner working in anything that is historically the art department's sort of sphere of influence in the production, and, you know, you feel that, you know, you're curious about representation, then you should contact us and contact Peter Casera at the guild, and Peter will give you the information, and we'll try to be as honest about, you know, what we can and can't do for you as
which is a very good important thing too, because I do think there's a lot of people who think that, you know, there's just some magic switch you throw and all of a sudden everything's all the problems.
There are no magic switches. There's no singular piece of software. It is a bundle. But, you know, I would say peter@artdirectors.org is the way to contact him. And he's there to answer those questions and try and, you know, hopefully bring clarity to what has been much too much confusion for too long. So.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck to all.
Well, we'd like to thank Tom Walsh for taking time to talk to us. And Jeff, I want to thank you for, you've really been the spearhead of this at FX Guide. It's really been your beat, as it were, to cover this. And you've done a tremendous job. And I thank you on behalf of everybody. I know you've had a lot of emails and people directly commenting on it.
I've had a lot of good, nice comments from people and appreciating the work. And I've got a couple lined up. I've got a labor attorney lined up for one of the next ones. He's in the middle of a very large case involving a different industry right now. But as soon as he wraps that up, we're going to sit down and just talk about labor laws again, probably with a California focus, but with an eye toward the global and what people can do in their own world to find out what their local labor laws are and what to do, what labor laws are and what they can do in their own lives if that's not being followed. So I think that, you know, I mean, to me, this is a topic I hear about a lot here in Los Angeles, and I have access to some of these people, so I figure it's a good thing for me to focus on.
Well, we appreciate it.
And you've been focused a lot. I know the new term just started over at PhD.
Yes.
How about that? I feel like a news reporter. That was a great segue, wasn't it?
Seriously, you've been doing a great job with some of these things, which has given us time to do other things because, of course, yes, I'm over at the sister site. We've been launching a new term at FX PhD, the April 2010. And I will say, Jeff, that on the end of the current FX Guide TV episode, which is actually an interview I did with the guys on Mari, the new paint program from the Foundry, the Weta, which is pretty awesome, actually, and actually really good to have on video because we did a written story about it, but you need to see how interactive it is to really kind of appreciate it. At the end of that, where there is a five-minute, I guess you'd call it infomercial, it's a piece showing you the new term at FXPSG, and it does have a lot of really interesting stuff, and I'm here in LA shooting for that right now. In fact, we were shooting yesterday doing stuff on HDRs.
Very cool, yeah, and I know there's a bunch of courses this term that piqued my interest. I know you're doing a maths class, which I know you've been making light of, but I think that there's a lot of us out there who are like, wow, you know, it's nice to, where are you going to find a class that's going to talk about the maths of visual effects? It's a different twist on, you know, moving beyond just doing the actual software.
Yeah. And also next week, of course, we'll all be in Vegas for NAB. I mentioned that at the top of the show. We have a number of podcasts, a number of FX Guide TV episodes and stories coming out of that. We've already got a bunch of great interviews lined up. So there's new stuff coming. Obviously, some new cameras are appearing, which is an area that interests me a lot these days, the Alexa and also the new Epic. So that'll all be good. So we'll be covering all of that from Vegas. We move over there this weekend and there'll be coverage all next week. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, and we'll be, obviously, if you follow us on Twitter, we're easy to find on Twitter. Check us out. We'll be tweeting from the show, too, for kind of...
What's your Twitter?
Neon Marg, based Neon on my neonmargarita.com domain, but Neon, N-E-O-N-M-A-R-G, and yours is Mike...
Mike Seymour. It's slightly unusual just to be as,
your name?
As dull as Mike Seymour, but there you go.
That's I got my name officially now. I did finally get that on Twitter, but I haven't started using it. I'm staying with Neon Marg because everybody kind of knows me. I've got a few followers there, so...
Okay.
And John is John Mont FX.
You bet.
So, yeah, that would be the best way to get live information. And then, like Mike said, we'll be doing podcasts and FX Guide TV episodes and bringing you as much information as we can, written stories, whatever we can get you, photographs. We'll post some on Flickr, I'm sure, and we'll put links to that. We really try to cover the
and
devil
a few
out
leaks.
Of
it. We can, yeah, there's a bit of stuff there that we haven't signed NDAs on that I'm keen to leak about, but I'll tell you more about that next week.
Ooh, okay. All right, well, thanks for listening, and...
And thank you, Jeff, for doing such great work on this labor issue.
Thanks.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.